Yo, what's up, everybody? It's another episode of Real Sankara Hours. Today is Saturday, August 26, 2023. It's another free episode for Real Sankara Hours, your favorite Pan-African socialist political podcast where we talk about politics, current events, race, culture from a Pan-African socialist lens. Yeah, we got a lot of stuff to talk about. Niger, Trump's mugshot. The Democrats and Joe Brandon afraid that they might lose black voters.
The BRICS summit.
The BRICS summit. Yes. So, yeah. So anyway, well, before we introduce ourselves, just quick housekeeping. We have a new website. So realsankarahours.org. So that's where, that website is basically where you can find us. On different platforms, but if you want to keep this kind of independent black political thought alive, $5 a month at patreon.com/realsankarahours gets you bonus episodes. So we read theory, break it down, and then talk about other stuff in our bonus episodes. So this is a free episode, but if you want access to more episodes, additional content, simply $5 a month gives you access to those episodes. And if you go to realsankarahours.org, that's our website, and you can find a subscribe button actually on there. So that button will take you to our Patreon, and then that's where you can choose to become a patron. And also there is a tier for like $3 a month where you don't get access to free episodes, but you it's basically a way for you to like show support at a lower cost, or you can also make just like a one-time contribution. We are not a nonprofit; we're a worker cooperative LLC. So this is a worker-owned cooperative business. So which means we're not capitalists in how we run things. So
partially because we don't have any capital, but
right, yeah, and also like you know we're socialists, so we believe in workers owning the means of production. So
the point is the donation's not tax deductible.
Yeah, but, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, that's the main reason why we mentioned that is because the donations are not tax deductible. So that's important to keep in mind. But again, if you want, those are ways to keep this podcast afloat and keep like I said, support independent black media. So anyway, realsankarahours.org, that's the website you can find how to subscribe and support us and all that. So anyway, with that out the way, my name's Adam Hudson.
And this is Peter M. Gunn. And yeah, I think we were initially gonna try and record last week, but it didn't work out. And then oh baby, you know, this is basically Pod Save America right now, because like, guys, did you see Trump got booked? He got a mugshot. Everything about the carceral state that we hate is actually great when it's against people we don't like politically.
Yeah. Yeah. Trump. Yeah. I'm going to be honest. A lot of the fucking coverage with Trump and he's going to get indicted. Like, he's going to get indicted. He's going to get indicted. He's going to get charged. I kept hearing that for the past like 2 fucking years. And I was like, okay, I don't know. So I had stopped paying attention until the fucking mugshot. And so
I mean, the guy knows his angles. He knows when the camera's on him. It's a mugshot you can fundraise off of. But yeah, him and I like Giuliani's better, honestly. But it was like Trump and 19 people on his campaign staff got hit with the RICO. Georgia's own RICO. The reason they're all getting booked and they getting mugshots is because it's not through the feds. This is like the state of Georgia and the Fulton County District Attorney's Office. And so this is over the call that surfaced, basically, where it was like Trump was like trying to get people to do election fraud in Georgia. And so the thing about RICO, it's like it basically exists to give prosecutors insane amounts of power, and they don't have to prove that you, like, were in a criminal conspiracy or whatever. Like, they just have to prove that people talked about what they thought was. They don't have to prove that they actually, like, did election fraud. They just have to prove that everyone was conspiring to do what they thought was election fraud. And, yeah, I mean, they definitely stack the charges. This is the thing, is that I don't poke around those corners of the internet, but I'm sure it's like, this is, trust and respect black women for, doing what everyone else was too afraid to do. And, but I would say that, the Fulton County DA's office, this is the same people that were just throwing, like, literal domestic terrorism charges at the protesters that were tree sitting in Atlanta to stop Cop City from being built.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't, like, be like, these guys are heroes. This is so cool. I mean, it's fucking hilarious. It's great content. And it's going to be great content for podcasts less scrupulous than ours for the next year. We love a good show trial, but I don't know. Like, I was going through all of the mugshots, and, like, this is still the American criminal justice system, because the one black person they indicted got denied bail and everyone else is out.
Yeah.
So.
He was like the Blacks for Trump or some shit.
Yeah.
Trump is facing 13 separate counts in Georgia, which include a racketeering charge and several fraud and false statement counts. It's him and 18 co-defendants. And so, yeah, there's like, I'm looking through the mugshots right now, and Trump, one of the co-defendants is fucking smiling. Like, what? Like, why are you smiling? You have a fucking mugshot, and you're fucking smiling as shit. And then Trump is, like, just looking at the camera all, like, pissed, and just with his, his signature hairpiece, like, just, yeah, he's like, why am I here? Fine, I have to take the picture. Why am I here? But he just looks looks pissed in this photo. And Rudy Giuliani, he's just like, God, he looks like shit.
Like, but Rudy Giuliani looks really bad.
He looks like complete shit in his picture.
It's hard. I think I like, if for our Gen Z listeners, I know we have some, it's hard to explain that, like, in 2001 he was America's mayor. He was like a national hero.
Yeah,
people loved Giuliani.
Yeah, because he was like the fucking 9/11 president, because September 11th happened in New York City. And so he got held up as America's mayor, he didn't really do anything. It was just like this kind of rally around the flag thing that happened immediately after 9/11. And so,
his presidential candidacy in 2004 had real traction. Or 2008, he wouldn't have ran against W, but in 2008, I think it had some real traction. I don't know. It's clear, like, Trump's not going to jail. Like, we're not ready for the precedent of sending ex-presidents to jail, because you'd have to send all of them to jail. But it's definitely clear somebody's going to jail. Probably just the black guy. But they'll get, like, a couple other. They're going to get there. And, I'm sure the way, this is how they talk about in DA's offices, they'll get their scalps.
Right. I also excuse me, like, one of, it's not that I'm opposed to Trump getting indicted, it's just, I think something to be on alert for is that this indictment, because I think, like, the kind of, like, liberal to left reaction to it, from what I've seen so far, is like, yes, like, the Cheeto is gonna go to prison now, like, and as if this is gonna signal some sort of significant political change that, like, you know, because I think people I think the spectacle of Trump and what he means for America, like, the liberal response is, if we can just get America back on track by putting Cheeto in prison, then we can stop paying attention to the Cheeto and things will be better. So I think, like, there's this, I think, misguided hope that putting Trump behind bars will do more than just, like, you know, than the principle of accountability, and that it will have, like, some sort of significant political impact. And I'm a lot more cynical about the prospects of that. I do think that one thing that is possible is that the right and his base will use this to make Trump seem like a martyr. And a comparison I would make would be to the Manosphere and Red Pill types who hold up Andrew Tate as some sort of martyr, even though, like, there's a lot of, you know, credible evidence to him being a sex trafficker and doing some, you know, heinous shit against women, in addition to the things he says. But, you know, when you listen to a lot of people in, like, the kind of Manosphere Red Pill space, the way they spin it is that, yeah, he allegedly did it, but, like, it's all bullshit, and, like, the Matrix and the elites are trying to go after him. This is a show trial. So, like I said, like, in that space, Andrew Tate is seen as, like, this martyr, and that it's like he's a victim of a witch hunt. So I think that's probably already happening or will happen in.
I mean, he's definitely gonna fundraise like crazy off the base. Yeah. I mean, yeah, the hardcore Trump people, this only fires them up. But
yeah, exactly.
Like, from an election campaign perspective, it's very hard to stay on message when, like, most of the coverage about you is your election fraud trial. And the suburban voters that are the only people Democrat election consultants care about, they're way turned off. They don't, this just only reinforces that they don't, like, want Trump around, which means that the Democrats can continue to do absolutely jack shit. Because they can just, and, you know, yes, with this going on, then, like, no one really has to hear about Hunter Biden anymore. Hopefully, I mean, it won't get as much coverage or whatever. Because, yeah, it's not like Biden is any sort of, epitome of non-corrupt statesmanship or whatever. But, you know, when there's an actual trial going on, and yes, it is a show trial, like, Americans should definitely get over themselves on, like, oh, we don't do political trial. Yes, we fucking do. We clearly always have. Like, I don't know. That's, like, one of those weird leftover Cold War things. Like, we don't do that. Yes, we obviously do. And it's fine. It's whatever. That's politics. As long as it's a good show. And it's going to be a good show. So, I don't know what else to say about it other than, you know, cool, I guess. He's not going to jail, but sure. Yeah. Somebody is, and The Daily Show, whoever's running The Daily Show now, like, they don't have to write anything for the next 18 months, so good for them.
Wait, actually, that's a good question. Who the hell is running The Daily
Show? Nobody. I don't know. The last time I watched it was, like, in December or something, and it was literally Sarah Silverman guest hosting for the week. They, like, don't have a host.
Oh, right, because, yeah, Trevor Noah left, and there's no...
Yeah, they've been doing it by committee, like, for the whole... since then.
Oh, my God.
Hilarious. But anyway, on to actual news, actual world events, and not that shit that we have to talk about, but like we don't really want to.
Yeah, so this is actually much more interesting. I mean, last month there was a coup in Niger, and it came on the heels of other military coups in Burkina Faso and Mali. So the previous leader Mohamed Bouazizi was ousted by I think it was. Let me make sure I get his name right. Just want to get the name right. So President Mohamed Bazoum was overthrown, and then the new leader General Abdurrahman Tchiani. Okay, yeah, because his last name is Tchiani, so it's General Tchiani in Niger. So this happened last month, and so and actually what was actually very major was Mali, Burkina Faso said that they would defend Niger in case of a military intervention, particularly by ECOWAS. So ECOWAS is the Economic Cooperation of West African Nations, and that's like a block of West African nations, and it's pretty much pro-West. It's aligned with...
Yeah, it's like run... It's kind of run by Nigeria. Like, Nigeria is the main player, and it is basically... Historically has been sort of... When you hear a foreign policy ghoul to be like, we need to rely on our allies and, like, our networks and stuff. Like, that's... ECOWAS is, like, basically there to intervene in a way that looks like it's not France and the U.S. doing it. And that, you know, they have a history of interventions going back to like the Liberian Civil War, and they're not pretty. It's not a thing that you like want to happen. But the thing is that U.S. foreign policy about Africa or the third world in general is basically just like, who's bad, election's good. And it's just this very reflexive thing. It doesn't really, like, Niger is, like, almost the poorest country in the world. Like, and it is home to a lot of uranium that France especially really enjoys getting for, you know, next to nothing. And, yeah, I mean, there's definitely ways it could develop, but, you know... The overarching strategy for development in Africa, I think, as we talked about, like, on the U.S. Africa Summit episode, is like, you have to have elections, they have to be perfect and clean, and then you can get aid for development. And it's like, if you're on the, like, you can't eat elections. Elections don't give you jobs if you're not a consultant. And so, like, honestly, like, most people on the ground, you know, in a lot of these countries, they're like, all right, dude, whatever. Like, but anyone who gets elected ends up having to cozy up to France anyway. So they fucking hate them. So it's like, they may go with the military strongman who, like, makes it seem like, you know, the country's going to stand up for itself. But it's a tricky situation because, yeah, like, ECOWAS isn't necessarily, you know, They're holding off on, like, a full-scale intervention, but they are doing good old, you know, America's favorite tool, sanctions, which, like, these are pretty rough because it's, like, Niger gets most of its electricity from Nigeria, so Nigeria, like, just cut off the power and, like, closed all the borders, so it's, like, literally people just driving trucks of cassava flour, like, can't get through, and it's like, you know, already this isn't a country that was doing all that great to begin with. And it's like, yeah, they're going to make it that much worse while they're, you know, working out a quote unquote transition to democracy. I think the most recent, you know, the junta said, like, you know, a 3-year transition. They're like, no, but like ECOWAS basically is like, you have to reinstate the person you just deposed, and nobody's gonna do that. If you just did a coup, you're not gonna uncoup yourselves. So that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, so. Yeah, because I think the Tchiani, I guess you could say regime, that's in power, I think what they're doing from what I can tell, is trying to actually like impose their, like basically create their own state order, so that like, yeah, because you're right, Peter, like when there's a coup that happens and is successful, like the first thing they're gonna do is basically become the state, like the new state apparatus, and run things. So you're not gonna reverse a coup when you already went through the effort to do a coup in the first place, right? So yeah, I don't think that's gonna happen. Like I don't think Chiani and like but I think like what like the West in terms of sanctioning, I think what their hope is that by starving the country and like even weakening the military, that it would somehow weaken the military junta. I think that's why like they're doing sanctions. It basically to disempower Chiani and those closest to him. So I think that's what they're, I think that's why they're doing that. Now, like in terms, so I guess the big question is like, why did this coup happen and what led up to it? And what are the what's the context behind it? What are the root causes? Well, Niger, along with a lot of West African countries, was colonized by France. So, Ghana, Nigeria, those countries were colonized by Britain. But most of West Africa, like Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, Ivory Coast, Benin to like Senegal, Guinea, Gambia was colonized by Britain, but most of West Africa and the Sahel region was colonized by France. And those countries gained their independence in the early 60s, along with a bunch of other African countries at that time. But those countries still retain like basically France has made it such that even if those countries are sovereign, that they still remain economically dependent on France. So
France-Afrique is the name of the special relationship.
Yeah, and so so they have to use French currency. French is still spoken in those countries. And a huge thing, a major thing, that isn't being talked about enough is that Niger is one of France's top three uranium suppliers, which is, uranium is very crucial for nuclear power. So France's top uranium suppliers in 2002 were Kazakhstan, Niger, and Uzbekistan. So France gets, like over the last 10 years, France has gotten 20% of its uranium from Niger. It got 27% of its uranium from Kazakhstan and 19% from Uzbekistan. So Niger is a major supplier of uranium to France and also the world. Like Niger is, even though it's one of the poorest countries in the world, it's sitting on a landmine when it comes to uranium. And it's one of the world's biggest uranium producers. And one of the issues from the people protesting the Bazoum regime is what the junta, what Chiani and Chiani accused Bazoum of, is Bazoum being essentially a traitor to Niger and kowtowing to France. So that was the accusation. And there are a lot of protests in Niger that are sympathetic with the coup. So that's a huge issue where, again, Niger is a very poor country, but it's sitting on very valuable natural resources. And they're like, hey, look, we're one of the poorest countries, but these minerals, we're sitting on them and we don't benefit from it. And the leadership in Niger and many West African countries, they have a very cozy relationship with the West. So that's been an issue in West Africa. And so I think, that's really a summary of what led up to this military coup, is basically these West African countries saying like, hey, look, we're sick of this neo-colonial relationship with the West. Now, the thing that's interesting is a lot of the military leaders who led these coups in West Africa actually got U.S. training. And so it puts a wrench in like the common leftist thesis of foreign policy that, oh, if there's like some sort of coup in a country and it's led by people who are trained by the U.S., therefore the coup is for U.S. interests, which has been proven true in a lot of cases. But in West Africa, in Niger, I think it doesn't line up with that argument, because I think it's kind of like a wild card. And so really, like, the main antagonist in this case is France. Now, where is the U.S. fit? Well, where the U.S. fits is the Sahel region of part of West Africa has been a site for U.S. Counterterrorism operations post 9/11,
and so especially post the Libya intervention.
Exactly, especially post Libya intervention, where it basically helped to create, I guess, quote unquote, like certain offshoots of Al Qaeda and the Islamic State. So the U.S. has counterterrorism interests in West Africa, and the U.S. is seems to be like waiting this out, and like kind of just, it seems like the U.S. at the moment is in terms of how its posture is with the coup, is sort of a wait and see. It's really France that's like, hey, we like that is. Really
get those colonies back in the line, because Niger was basically kind of one of the last holdouts of like a reliable French partner. The U.S. military obviously doesn't care about democracies. They don't, you know, the right. people, yeah, the junta group, they're not so stupid as to like try and kick the Americans out, because then they really wouldn't survive. And there are, you know, like 1,100 to 1,200 U.S. troops in Niger that we know of. Because I don't know if anyone remembers back,
and a drone base as well. Just sorry,
yes, up, and
drones,
drone base in Agadez, where Mdou Mokhtar is from, and some really great guitar music comes out of that part of Niger. They're not going to do that. But the State Department is very much like, you know, we've got to have elections. We democracy, guys. We want to feel like we're doing something. So, but yeah, you know, I want to say, like, I suppose in the inter-imperialist rivalry, one of the more endearing things about Joe Biden is he really doesn't give a shit about France. And so he seems to be okay letting France hang out to dry on this one. And, you know, I think everyone wants to be able to resolve the issue without, you know, an actual intervention, because that's just more violence and bloodshed and, you know, more of the stereotype of Africa being war-torn and can't solve its own problems or whatever. But, you know, it's not like the United States is, like, a huge partner for, you know, prosperity and development in that area either. It's really more like it's easier to deal with the Americans, because everyone knows, like, the thing about France is that its economy, like, cannot really support itself without extracting wealth from Africa, like,
exactly
all the way down to, like, its, you know, wonderful little social democracy state that, you know, they set on fire every 6 months. They couldn't afford to do that if they weren't stealing extracting wealth from Africa. Like, it's a very codependent relationship France has, and so they are a little bit just like, you know, I thought this whole NATO thing was supposed to work. And, you know, Macron is trying to throw his weight around.
Emmanuel Macron.
Yes, but it seems like he's not really good at doing it in West Africa. We'll obviously continue to watch the story.
And a few more points before we transition, because this will actually, I think this point will help us transition to the next thing we want to bring up, which is BRICS, the BRICS summit. So I think like another main takeaway from this coup is that there actually at these protests there have been a lot of like a lot there's been a lot of pro-Russia sentiment. And you know, in the West, particularly in America, it's like, what, why are they pro-Russia? Because the West and Western countries, especially with the war in Ukraine, the Russian invasion of Ukraine that's been going on for like about a year and a half at this point, they've been trying to tell African countries, like, why don't you support Ukraine? Like, why don't you support us, you know, against Russia? And African countries like, like, we have our own problems. Like, you know, like,
I thought you guys knew what colonialism was, okay? Why don't you support NATO?
You know, I was actually listening to this interview that Rania Kalik had with Felix Biederman. I think this interview was like last year or something. And Rania Kalik, she's a journalist, and she used to be based in the U.S., but now she lives in Beirut, Lebanon right now. And she was saying, like, the mood within, like, the global South when it comes to Ukraine is largely like, well, at least it's not us. You know, it's basically like countries that have been through, like, wars and coups and, like, U.S. interventions. Like, when they see the war in Ukraine, it's like, yeah, that sucks, but hey, at least it's not us. And so they have their own concerns. And so the West has been trying to, like, tell Africa, like, you guys have to be part of, like, the, you know, our team and do what we say, you know, because ECOWAS is part of, like, the whole EU-NATO kind of block, basically, foreign policy block. This idea of these alliances that are supposed to be about preserving norms in the international order, right? So it's basically like some international order that is established under the leadership of Europe and the US, right? So ECOWAS is like part of that club, basically, that EU NATO club. So yeah, they're very pro Western Europe, and so they have that relationship with Europe. But you know, I think like what's one thing this coup shows right now, because I think like, you know, there's still like a wait and see in terms of what's going to happen in the future. So there's a lot of stuff that's still largely up in the air. But I think one thing this coup shows is the whole U.S. NATO international order is being challenged by BRICS countries in the global South. And so I think what this coup shows is countries in Africa saying, you know what, we're going to go in our own direction. We don't really care about what you think. You can't tell us what to do. And it's like, hey, if we want to go with Russia, we'll go with Russia. We want to go with China, we'll go with China. Like, we don't care. We'd rather deal with them than deal with France, because basically what these African countries are saying is that, look, our relationship with Western Europe has always been one-sided. You guys have always, like, pretty much did us dirty, and so, like, fuck you. Like, we don't care. Like, if we want to partner with China, we'll partner with China. We'll partner with Russia if we want to. And so that's why there's been Russian flags being flown in these protests. And in the West, because, you know, these days, like when you drive around in America, like, there's a lot of blue and yellow flags in solidarity with Ukraine. So from the U.S. Yeah. perspective, people looking at these protests seeing Russian flags, they're like, what? Are they siding with the enemy? Like, why are they siding with evil Russia? And, like, obviously, look, yes, like, we don't support the war in Ukraine. Like, I think the Russian invasion was wrong, and the bloodshed and civilian deaths are, like, horrendous and horrifying, and I think, and this is something I said in a previous episode, that I think the war in Ukraine is being prolonged because it's a testing ground for new military weapons, particularly AI guided weaponry. So I think that's a big reason why the war is prolonged in Ukraine. But to circle it back to Niger, I think what this is showing is essentially a challenge to that U.S. NATO established international order. And it's almost like a rebalancing of the world, and almost in a world where it's no longer this unipolar world where the U.S. is a dominant, like the global police. It's now it's like, okay, well, it's going to be evened out by the rise of China. And, you know, regardless of one's feelings, I mean, like I said, like we don't support the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but look, like Russia has like serious power. And so to have like, I guess, a global order, it is going to entail having to work with countries like China and Russia for shared interests, especially when it comes to climate change. That's going to impact everybody. The fate of humanity in the face of rising temperatures is going to entail working with Russia and China, right? Like climate change, like there have been wildfires in Russia, like in northern Russia. So, you know, on certain issues that impact the world itself, we'll have to entail, again, having some sort of working diplomatic relationship with these countries in pursuit of shared interest. And so I don't think it's in anybody's interest to extremely antagonize like countries like China. But yeah, so I think like the coup in Niger shows that the world seems to be going in a slightly more multipolar direction. And you know, the U.S. and the West are going to have to grapple with that, whether they like it or not, you know, because I think it's just something that's just going to happen. And so, so the U.S. and the West can't bully African countries to say, like, how dare you not blah, 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 blah. Like, that's not going to work anymore. It's just not.
I also want to say, yeah, I think, because at first it was kind of like, oh, well, yeah, coups happen in countries that people don't care about, and it usually doesn't make the news. But then because one of them reached out to the Wagner Group, I think that's when, like, U.S. media started freaking out. But, I don't know if that help's going to be coming anytime soon, as I think we all saw Prigozhin, who we talked about earlier, the head of Russia's main private military contractor, because it's funny how Russia has mercenaries and the U.S. has private military contractors. I always find that funny.
Right, the terminology.
Yes,
yeah.
Well, he was exiled to Belarus, but somehow found himself in a private plane going from St. Petersburg to Moscow. I would say RSH advice, if you try to lead a coup and you fail, then you get exiled to a country. Don't go back to the country that you tried to do the coup in. Of course, a mysterious plane crash is going to happen. They made short work of that guy. So, but that's also to say that, like, the Russian boogeyman in terms of, like, Russia being able to be a rival imperialist bloc in Africa is, it's so far removed from even attempting to have that capability, and right. China as well. Like, mm-hmm. if people right. just like look at the fucking numbers on this shit, like, you know, in terms of who actually has the capital and like military hardware and everything to pull this off, neither of those countries are anywhere close to rivaling the U.S. and NATO in terms of like who. So, which is like, and I feel like a lot of lefties fall for this too, and they're like, inter-imperialist rivalries. You know, neither Washington, nor Moscow, nor Beijing, just like standing in the middle and loudly proclaiming nothing. Like, we got to be honest in terms of like who the actual role players are. I mean, yes, it is a changing world, and we'll get to that next, but like, we're not there yet. Like, right now, there's still the imperial core and the semi-periphery and the periphery, and the imperial core is still like, overall, what they say goes. It's just they're, you know, having some difficulties among themselves. But yes, also this week in Johannesburg was the BRICS summit. Vladimir could not attend. He was there in spirit and on Zoom, because yes, the ICC did issue an arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin, and if he showed up in South Africa and the South African government didn't arrest him, the United States was going to be very, very angry with him. And, you know.
Very angry.
Yes. No, they were very clear about this.
Wagging fingers, you know.
So, you know, you got to pick your battles. But it seemed to have been productive because they came out with a new lineup. And this, I don't know, I think it's an impressive lineup.
This lineup, you know, BRICS obviously stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And so this next lineup in the BRICS team, so they agreed to admit Saudi Arabia, Iran, Ethiopia, Egypt, Argentina, and the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, which is like,
there's some money right there.
A baller ass lineup, shit. Like,
I mean, not that we love the governments of a lot of those countries.
No, but especially like Saudi Arabia. Also, has a very cozy relationship with the U.S. And also, I think that the Saudi royal family had something to do with 9/11. But that's all other.
at the very least, Saudi intelligence. I don't know who called that. Royal family, but yeah.
Yeah, the that's what I mean. Yeah, I should clarify. I think Saudi intelligence had some knowledge about knowledge about 9/11, but that can be saved for another episode. But point is that we're not particular fans of the governments of any of these countries, but hey, it's interesting. Like, it is observe.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, Ethiopia is the second biggest country in Africa, population wise. You know, Egypt is actually for all of Sisi's problems, like, Egypt's doing pretty stable. It's doing pretty well. The U.S. tried to, like, make them fight each other over, I think, Egypt. Ethiopia wanted to, like, dam the Nile, I think. And, you know, it's nice. It's just nice to see, I guess, that, like, countries who have more interest in cooperating than fighting each other are realizing, you know, what their own shared interests are. Because, like, I mean, a lot of what this boils down to is, like, most of the world doesn't really, you know, people are ready to not have the dollar be the world reserve currency. And, but, you know, it's also just, like, in the global economic interest to have, like, one currency, or, you know, it's, you know, everything's more efficient if you have one. And so there's been talk about, like, a BRICS currency, and, like, alternative sources of development funds and stuff like that. So you don't have to go through the World Bank and IMF, because these are also, you know, controlled by Atlantic capital, let's say, you know, US and Western Europe. And so, yeah, I mean, adding, like, the biggest oil exporters to the club will, you know, can provide some good cash infusions. You know, I think it's definitely a thing that people have a lot of emotions about. I mean, you know, I think we all, any sane thinking person who has the interests of humanity at large, like, should want the American Empire to disintegrate or dismantle itself as peacefully as possible. Yeah. You know, we may have a more realistic view about what that will actually take because of the insane psychopaths that run this thing. But like,
and also, like, serious, very, very serious internal divisions within the U.S., especially when it comes to, like, issues of race, and particularly, like, the inherent contradiction within the U.S. about how it deals with the descendants of enslaved Africans. And so, yeah, there's some, like, really serious internal contradictions within the U.S. that have to be wrestled with as the U.S. Empire, I guess, disintegrates or weakens and as peacefully as possible, because I'm still concerned about the future of Black America in, like, let's say, some sort of revolutionary post-imperial America. I'm concerned about, like, what the future for Black Americans and Native Americans would look like. But anyway, yeah, I just wanted to add that there are also some serious internal contradictions that the U.S. Still not just has yet to wrestle with, but I think huge segments of the country do not want to wrestle with. So,
yeah, that's true. And also, it seems like on the far right, they're like too stupid for their own good to understand like how to keep the empire running. Like, they really don't get that part, I guess, somehow. Like, that's always what you need the liberals for, because they're the ones actually paying attention. And, like, yeah. Well, that's the whole thing. It's like, once you actually get to D.C., like, everyone's liberal, because that's the liberal order is the one that keeps the West on top. And because if it's, you know, blood, pound for pound, blood for blood, like, there's just a lot more people who have a lot more to lose, or they're willing to fight a lot more than Americans are for this shit, you know, if that's what it has to come down to, because that's their future. And yeah, I mean, nobody wants to see that happen, but, you know, history, like, you pay attention to it. You can see the cycles or whatever. But this is also new. I mean, this is like an unheralded era of like international cooperation, I think it's also worth looking at it that way, because yeah, I mean, you know, going back to like the League of Nations or whatever, like in the you know, mostly decolonized world, like, it still has the remnants in the superstructure of you know, the colonial order. And, like, it needs to aggressively be reformed, like, the global system of governance, international affairs, and economics and finance. Like, it doesn't exist for the interest of developing countries. And they know that. Yeah. They're not stupid. But every short-sighted politician will always, like, pick the more powerful partner instead of realizing, you know, the long-term interest, which is that, you know, these countries have more in common with each other, and they have more to gain by working together than by letting the U.S. play them off of each other. So, you know, we'll see what happens. But I would feel comfortable filing it as another installment of the State Department Hose Mad series.
Yeah.
I think there's definitely some parts of Foggy Bottom that are big mad about, you know, the BRICS expanding, and there's, you know, like another 20 countries that are clamoring to get in on the fun. I mean, it really, like, I think it's one of those things that you can't see it until it happens, but, like, the only thing that's, like, seems less plausible than, like, an actual challenger to the dollar is the idea that, like, the dollar's just gonna reign supreme for until the end of human history. Like,
yeah,
the rest of the world's just not gonna put up with that.
That's also like another like $1 million question is, yeah, why the US dollar remains the world's currency, and like what's the check on it? Because it seems like the only check on like the US being the world's reserve currency, it at least the internal contradiction that if the US can keep printing its own currency and paying itself back, because the US, the reason why, like, you know, this is why, like, the whole, when the right sort of fucking complains about the U.S. is in debt, it's in debt. Like, we have to cut spending because of the fucking debt. We can't have fucking food stamps and the welfare state.
Not the fudge rounds, guys. Not the, no more fudge rounds.
Yeah, like, so, here's the thing, like, when the U.S. cannot go, quote-unquote, broke, because in order, like, the way debt works at its most simple, the simplest way to understand like debt is one person owes another person. There's a debtor and there's a creditor, right? So, one person owes the other, right? So you take out like a loan from a bank, right? You become the debtor and the bank is the creditor, right? So the creditor is the person or the entity that issues the debtor is a person who owes money on that debt, right? So if the U.S. is the debtor, who is the creditor? It's the U.S. government. So the U.S. government is both the creditor and the debtor in this. So it doesn't really owe anybody outside of itself anything. So the way it takes care of its debt or its deficits is to just print more money, right? That's the only way. It's like print more money.
Yeah.
So it can't like go broke. But the check on that is if the U.S. keeps running deficits and keeps printing more money to pay off those debts, what happens is you get inflation. So the dollar becomes like worth less over time, right? That's like the only like probably the most serious check on the U.S. being the world reserve currency is internally, that if the U.S. just keeps printing a shit ton of money to pay off its debts, then that means the value of the dollar goes down, right? And that also spells trouble for countries that have debts issued in U.S. currency, right? So it screws them over. So I don't know of any other way where, like, I mean, well,
literally the muscle of the U.S. military is also the way that we enforce our status as the world reserve currency. I miss all the great, like, yeah, you know, Saddam is about to go off the dollar and like Gaddafi is about to go off the dollar. I mean, you know, there's other reasons for that. But it is true. Once the U.S. went off the gold standard in 73, like, it's basically the creation of the petrodollar, which is basically like all of Saudi Arabia, basically like the entire oil market has to be conducted in dollars. And that was the concession that Saudi Arabia gave in exchange for not being completely leveled in 1974 because of the oil crisis, when Saudi Arabia just boycotted production for the U.S. because of its support for Israel. And that's, you know, the long line. I mean, I don't even know how many people know about this. If you had like boomer parents, they would tell you about the oil crisis and, you know, I can't drive 55 and all that stuff. And there are crazy lines at the gas station, and everything. That was back when Saudi Arabia had a little more of a third worldist. There are different flavors of the ruling family, you know, like, there are different political factions and stuff. That was like more of a third worldist. It seems like they might be coming back. I mean, I guess. I don't, you know. But the addition of Saudi Arabia and Iran, like, and the UAE, like, big oil exporters into the BRICS bloc is, there's some heft to it now. And some actual capital, which they can, like, fund real development banks and stuff. Because the thing is that, like, yes, if the U.S. empire collapses overnight, there's a vacuum. And then it's going to be one country has to race to fill the vacuum. The truth is, it doesn't matter what China wants to do or whatever. Or like, oh, yeah, no, you know, sneaky, sneaky Chinese tending their fingers and plotting because they want to be just like us. Nah, dude. I mean, if there's any country, it's not. China, like, could have done global imperialism for 1,000 years, and they're like, nah, man. Because they're, in their mind, they're, you know, in the, like, extreme Chinese nationalist mind, it's like, we're the center of the universe. We're already number one. Everyone should come to us. We don't need to, like, go out and take over the rest of the world, because we're already the best. But they also, like, don't have the capability to replace the U.S. empire. And nobody does. And so that's like the point. This is like what being materialist is about this. It's not about whether like some system of government ideology is like better morally, like that, you know, the hearts are pure in America, the American ruling class, because it's like, yeah, we're doing all this bad stuff, but like we have values or something, or some dumb shit, some wasp, dumb bullshit. It's literally just like China doesn't have the capability. And certainly they wouldn't, like, they don't have the capability, nor the desire, nor the internal political will to do that. Neither does Russia. Nobody has the capability to replace the U.S. the way the U.S. replaced Britain. So like, the only way out of it is through an previously unprecedented system of global cooperation by developing countries. Like, that's what has to happen. So there's not really a choice. So, I suppose people can fumble the bag again and, we end up with another American century. I mean, you know, it ain't over yet, but, like, these are positive developments, I think.
Yeah. And to close out the final item that, we'll talk about, you know, to add to the hose mad shit, Democrats, Democratic Party, they're not just mad, they're fucking worried. So there's this article in the Washington Post that came out on July 31st that says, Democrats worry their most loyal voters won't turn out for Biden in 2024. Who are their most loyal voters? Black people. So Democrats are like, oh, fuck, black people aren't excited for us anymore? Huh? So I'm just kind of going to read it. I mean, it's not too long. So the article says, Democrats are worried about a potential drop next year in turnout among black voters, the party's most loyal constituency who played a consequential role in delivering the White House to President Biden in 2020 and will be crucial for his bid for re-election. Their concern stems from a 10 percentage point decline in black voter turnout in last year's midterms compared with 2018. A bigger drop than among any other racial or ethnic group, according to a Washington Post analysis of the Census Bureau's turnout survey. Such warning signals were initially papered over by Democratic successes in 2002. The party picked up a U.S. Senate seat in Pennsylvania. Senator Raphael G. Warnock won re-election in Georgia, and anticipated losses in the House were minimal. But in key states like Georgia, the center of Democrats' plans to mobilize black voters in large margins for Biden in 2024, turnout in last year's midterms was much lower among younger and male black voters, according to internal party analysis. The drop in black turnout has become a focus for Democratic leaders as the party reorients to next year's presidential contest. Biden's election in 2020 hinged on narrow victories in states like Georgia, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania that former President Donald Trump had won in 2016. Democratic activists are cautioning that the party can't afford to let support from black voters slip. W. Mondale Robinson, founder of the Black Male Voter Project, shared a dire assessment of Democrats' potential turnout problems with black men. In many of the battleground states, he said many black men are, quote, sporadic or non-voters, meaning they are registered but have voted in one or none of the past three presidential elections. Robinson said, Democrats spend too much time focused on converting conservative-leaning white women in the suburbs who they see as swing voters. Instead, he said, they should focus more on turning out black men, viewing them as swing voters who are debating whether to stay or stay home. The Democratic Party has been failing epically at reaching this demographic of black men, and that's sad to say, Robinson said. Black men are your second most stable base overwhelmingly, and yet you can't reach them in a way that makes your work easier. Biden's political team says it has received the message and is taking action, especially among younger black men. We have to meet them where they are, and we have to show them why the political process matters and what we have accomplished that benefits them, said Cedric L. Robinson, a former Biden advisor who is now a senior advisor at the Democratic National Committee. He said there will be a clear focus on making black voters aware of how they have benefited from Biden administration policies, learning from the errors of past Democratic efforts that fell short. We will not make the mistake that others made of not drawing all the connections, he said. So it further explains what they think is a reason for why black men are not turning out. But I thought the one part that was interesting is that Robinson said, Mondale Robinson pointed out, which I think is true. Like, when you look at the Democratic Party's electoral strategy in terms of how they try to reach out voters. They just assume that black people are just going to vote willy-nilly for the Democratic Party, right? So it's like, so they don't bother to like basically reach out and turn out to them because they assume that, oh, black people are just going to vote for us anyway. So there's no reason to. So they're focused on upper middle class white people in the suburbs, particularly conservative leaning white women in the suburbs. So, but I think Robinson's correct in that it is a fool's errand for like the Democrats. And keep in mind, I don't think the Democratic Party represents like the interests of black people. But if the idea is that like, okay, well, lesser of two evil voting, we can't have the Republicans get in power. Like, okay, I agree that it's not good to have Republicans in power, but like if that's the goal, then it doesn't make sense to try to woo conservative leaning suburban white women to the Democratic Party when black men, which is true, are the second most stable base in the Democratic Party. The others would be black women. So the Democratic Party, I think, looks at black women as like, okay, well, they're absolutely in lock. Black men, it's like, okay, well, they're just going to like fall behind us anyway and might even follow the lead of black women. So it's just like, all right, well, don't have to do much effort. But what's being shown is that with black men, it's not that black men are turning conservative. It's just a lot of black men aren't even voting. And that is spelling trouble for the Democratic Party, especially in, I think, a state like Georgia, where it is growing more of a purple state. So there are certain, because of fucking gerrymandering, the turnout of black men could make the difference in certain elections, particularly on when it comes to Congress or the Senate or even the presidency. So I think he's right that the Democrats do expend a lot of unnecessary effort in trying to woo conservative,
yes,
leading this, white women.
Which is why they threw a million fucking charges at Trump, because that's going to play like crazy in the suburbs.
Yeah.
There are two things that I'm struck with upon hearing this article. One is, dear God, voter died's going to come back. Like, every single time the fucking Democratic Party tries to reach out to working class young black men, it is like the most patronizing minstrel show fucking shit you've ever seen.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, no wonder people don't want to fucking vote for you, because this is like so disgusting. Like, you're really demonstrating what you think of us when you run the shit that you run. The second thing is the concept of reminding black voters everything that Biden has done for them. And I'm like, what? What on earth could you possibly be talking about?
Right. Yeah.
All you've done is create more austerity measures, like make it harder to be poor. I mean, you made it so that bill collectors can harass you on social media. That was something Biden did. I don't know how many black people it affected. Ban menthol cigarettes. Is that what they're going to go for? Or cracking down on them? Like, what the hell are you fucking talking about? You, like, none of the issues that one would think black men would care about, like police violence, incarceration, anything like that. Joe Biden has done, like, aggressively, he's made it worse. Like, what are you, like, what the hell could you possibly have to say? And that's, like, that's my point always. That's why I'm not fucking voting for this piece of shit. And the only reason I did before was because it was the last request of my dying father. I'm not kidding. Like, otherwise, I'm never voting for a Democrat again, because what the fuck, like, it's just disgusting. Like, what do you think you're doing? I don't get it. I don't get, at this point, how any of these people could take themselves seriously. How do you take yourself seriously? Like, you know what it is that you're doing. You know whose interests you represent. You know what you're actually doing to people. And then you want to come around and be like, oh, man, you know, we're upset because they're not enthusiastic about voting for the guy who's been screwing them over. Like, I don't get it. I don't. This is the thing where it's like, yeah, these people are so far up their own asshole, like election consultants and all these people. And some of them feel the burn or whatever. Like, you can hear through consultants speak like, guys, this is actually a problem. But their jobs don't depend on them not acknowledging, like, Yeah, because I thought at least for a second to be like, okay, well, you know, they'll like get rid of some mandatory minimums or something like that. No, they're not fucking doing it. They're making it more carceral. Like I just said, like,
Yeah.
you know, the election showpiece of the Democratic Party was literally like denying the one black guy bail. Like in those 19, like it's the same fucking racist system and everyone knows it. So what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah, and also the Democratic Party, and not just the Democratic Party, but I would say like people within education, academia, media in particular, and I think other segments of society, like the political space, I think like their view of black men is like they see black men as 2-year-olds. And especially like in terms of how the Black Democratic Party tries to reach out to black men with like the kind of dumb get out to vote like minstrel shit, is basically they see black men as 2-year-olds. Like they don't see black men as like capable of understanding their own material conditions and making political decisions based on that. So I think like at the core of it, and I would say not even just like in those particular like sectors of America, I would say in America in general, like the view of black men is incredibly demeaning, really. If you really think about it, like if we really want to fucking go there, like you could be a black man with like a degree from a top 5 university and still not get respect anywhere, really. And I can speak on that just myself. It's like, you know, like some people are like kind of shocked, like, oh wow, you're so smart and articulate. I'm like, yeah, huh? Like you, it like it didn't dawn on you that like black men could like, I don't know, read books and have a big fucking vocabulary? That's how a lot of people view black men. If we really want to get serious, fucking serious about it, that is a view of black men in general. And I think the Democratic Party is showing their ass on this, that, and it's having an impact that black men are just like, yeah, you know what? Psh, fuck off. Who cares? So I think like on a deeper level, the dehumanization of black men in particular, and looking at black men like we're 2-year-olds, I think a lot of black men are catching whiff of that and are just like, all right, well, you don't take me seriously, I don't take you seriously, so we're just not gonna vote. So I'll continue with the article because this Washington Post article gets into some of the reasons why black men are tuning out. I think they get some of it right, but I think, you know, can we're here to go much deeper than what the Washington Post says. So it continues. Black voter advocates say the challenge is particularly acute among black men, many of whom they say feel alienated from the political process and were hurt by policies pushed by both parties that led to increased incarceration and a decline in manufacturing jobs decades ago. Many say their lives haven't improved regardless of which party was in power, and are dispirited after the country elected Trump. Life was upended by a global pandemic, and violence worsened in urban areas. Many Democrats interviewed said they were less worried about black women, whose voting enthusiasm has historically been more robust than that of black men. Black women were a huge factor in Biden's victory in 2020. Advocates expect that trend to continue, particularly with Vice President Harris on the ticket and the appointment of Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, who both made history as the first black women in their roles. So that is true. Like I do think it's true that black women are more enthusiastic when it comes to voting for the Democratic Party.
I don't think it's because of Kamala Harris, though.
No, I don't think it's because of Kamala Harris. I just think like well, I think, you know, on a gendered level, there are stats to prove this, that women across racial lines tend to vote more with the Democrats. Now, with the exception of white women, plenty of fucking conservative ass white women. But like I would say with non-white women, women of color, like Asian, Black, Latina, like I think they tend to vote more Democrat than than the men in the communities. Now, that doesn't mean, like, men in minority ethnic communities are all, like, Republican. It's just, I do think that, I think in general...
A lot of them got disenfranchised from mass incarceration also.
It's yeah.
To remember.
There, yeah,
funny how that one worked out.
So I just want to, like, echo, like, yeah, I think, like, there is a case to be made that Black women are more enthusiastic. Vote for the Democrats more.
Oh,
enthusiastically. I don't think it's for the reasons that they list here, but... Yeah, definitely, like, the role that mass incarceration played and how it impacted Black men and made it such that, like, you know, in many states that if you have, like, a criminal record or you're a felon, then you can't vote. Yeah, like, that played a huge fucking role in terms of Black men in the vote. But anyway,
I also don't know, and these articles never get into, like, if the turnout rates for Black women are that much higher than they are for Black men. I think they're relatively low for Black people as a whole. It's just that when Black women do vote, they vote like at a 90% level for the Democratic Party. And so that's like why the Democrats have this weird, you know, Black girl magic thing going on. And with Stacey Abrams, particularly for some reason, because they think she talks to all Black women. But I think if you're poor and Black, like, you just don't really vote. So that's, and like,
that's even with Black women too, like, poor Black women. Like, I think there's a similar jadedness that they're overlooking with Black women who are lower income. But yeah, like, there is this kind of, like, facade of, like, Black girl magic that the Democrats are trying to play up in. I think it does play to, I would say, a certain demographic of Black women, and that demographic of Black women are not, like, lower income, working class Black women. I think that's a crop of Black women who were, like, to put it bluntly, like the Ebony K. Williams types, right? Like the Amanda Seals, who are incredibly well educated and have a level of, let's be honest, like, economic privilege that I would say the vast majority of Black women just don't fucking have, right? So I think, like, especially, like, yeah, if we're talking about, like, Black women and Black girl magic, like Black women are gonna fucking save us, like, okay. So does it help Black women that, like, the police keep shooting their brothers and fathers
and them too,
like, how the fuck, like, Jesus fucking Christ. Yeah, Terrence Woodbury, chief executive of HIT Strategies. The fuck HIT's cap? Oh, okay, sorry. HIT Strategies, a polling firm focused on young non-white voters, has been shopping around a PowerPoint presentation to liberal groups warning of the need to act soon to convince Black voters that they have benefited from Biden's time in office. Part of the problem, he argues, is that the party's focus on Trump and Republican extremism is less likely to motivate younger Black men than arguments focused on policy benefits. The messaging, he has argued, excuse me, belch right there. The messaging, he has argued, must focus on how Black communities have benefited from specific policies. Okay, well, they don't mention which policies, that's the problem. They don't mention the specific
policies. Yes, the problem with your messaging strategy is that you have no policies of which to speak of.
Right.
And so that's going to be a bit of a messaging hurdle since you haven't done anything for any Black people. But, you know, Democrats can pull it out. I wanted to also make the point that, like, in the 90s and 2000s, like, you know, when deindustrialization, mass incarceration hit Black communities the hardest, like, yeah, a lot of Black women did benefit from, like, the greater push towards education. They are overall more educated for XYZ reasons. I mean,
yeah,
public education system.
Yeah, like formal education, yeah.
Yeah, so that is, like, also why there may be a higher turnout. I mean, perhaps you could argue that it's just that the public education system is just particularly hostile to Black boys. And so, that's why they don't do as well in it. But also, yes, the lack of, like, jobs that could provide for families as well. you know, yeah. So anyway, that's like, if you want to like ask the question in a non-pathologizing way, which most of these people who write these articles aren't interested in doing, they're interested in finding new ways to pathologize black men. That's like an actual answer.
Yeah. So we'll continue. His own polling has shown that voters' belief that their vote doesn't matter is the greatest barrier to voting among black Americans. A Washington Post Ipsos poll of black Americans in May found a tepid reaction to Biden's reelection. Just 17% said they would be enthusiastic if he wins another term. 48% said they'd be satisfied but not enthusiastic. 25% said they'd be dissatisfied but not angry. At 8%, they said they'd be angry about another Biden term. The poll also found that nearly 8 in 10 black Americans say they would not consider voting for Trump over Biden, and that 54% would be angry if Trump were to become president again. Brittany Smith, the executive director of the Philadelphia-based Black Leadership PAC, BLP, which is working to turn out black voters, said she has noticed a change in how black people respond to her Get Out the Vote efforts in recent years. In the past, she simply needed to remind people of where and when to vote. Now, she said, many express a cynicism about politics that requires a deeper level of persuasion. So that's interesting. I'm gonna read that again because I think this is important. So like, there is a poll on like, okay, how black people feel about Biden winning, and so it's like, yada yada, whatever. But I'm gonna read this part again because I think it bears repeating. So the Brittany Smith, she works on turning out black voters, and says she has noticed a change in how black people respond to her Get Out the Vote efforts in recent years, right? So in recent years, in the past, she simply needed to remind people of where and when to vote, right? So that's been a norm. Like, okay, try to turn out black voters, just remind people of where and when to vote. Now, she said, many express a cynicism about politics that requires a deeper level of persuasion. There's not a night I don't go to sleep thinking about what turnout will look like in 2024, Smith said. When you think about election cycle to election cycle, black voters have been telling us for a long time what matters, Smith said. They want to put food on the table, a roof over their head, send kids to good schools, live in neighborhoods that are safe. I don't think the issues are new. It's the way we talk about them and the way we're centering the voices of the people who live in these communities. I would also add, beyond just a centering of voices, implementing policies that address those needs, right? Like that's she's right. There is a real increasing level of cynicism among black people writ large, and I think black men are probably even have a deeper level of cynicism, but I think the cynicism of black men is shared by a lot of black women. I think like black men, because the war on drugs got fucked over even worse. I think the black male cynicism of politics is reflective of growing cynicism among black people in general about politics. And so she's right. Like black voters have said for a long fucking time the issues that matter specifically to black people, which are specific material concerns. Food on the table, roof over the head. So food, housing, right? Like think of this housing instability that exists for large numbers of black people, both renters and homeowners, right? The small percentage that are fucking homeowners in the country. Sending kids to good schools, living in safer neighborhoods, right? Like,
oh, well, see, this is where the Democrat comes out, because it's like safer neighborhoods, which is, you know, back, oh, you know how many black churches supported the crime bill? I mean, safer neighborhoods means also ones not terrorized by the police. But yes, they even after the fucking whole ass fucking movement, these fucking consultants still can't come out and say, like, yeah, like, you have to actually do something about the police, you fucking cowards. But, you know, this is where that, and that's why black people have cynicism towards the Democratic Party. It's because of bullshit like that. Like,
yeah, exactly. Because think of, okay, 2020, George Floyd. Everybody saw that video of George Lives George Floyd's life being snuffed out by the cops, right? And there's protests all throughout the country and around the world. What happened as a result? Like, nothing, really.
Biden gave more money to police.
Gave more money to police. And this is to these fucking assholes who are like, oh, like, you know, liberals defund the police. No, that did not fucking happen. What, the police got more money. What happened is that, like, they have trouble recruiting new officers. And part of the reason is like, well, people don't want to become cops because people have seen videos of cops being fucking assholes. And they're like, I don't know if I want to be a cop. I gotta be surrounded by,
you know,
motherfuckers who are racist and trigger happy.
Most of humanity are not psychopaths, turns out.
Yeah, so that's the problem, especially in San Francisco. I believe we mentioned an article like that maybe a couple weeks ago. Is that, like, San Francisco has a staffing shortage, really. It's not a funding issue, it's staffing. They have trouble recruiting new officers. And part of it is, like, people don't want to become police. And it's because, largely because, like, people have seen videos of cops being fucking pieces of shit. And people are like, huh, I don't know if I want to join that. Like, I'm not a trigger happy asshole. Like, you know, so, yeah, like, after George Floyd, there was no police, there really hasn't been really any significant police reform. Maybe some, like, window dressing here and there.
No, I mean, like, if anything, they've been killing more. Like,
they actually,
the numbers are stable slash trending upward in terms of police killings. Like, if we just stop talking about it again, but
yeah. So no, that's true. And I'm gonna put that number in. Yeah, like police killings. The number of police killings haven't changed. They've gone slightly up. So, I mean, they're. Maybe at some departments, there's been like, okay, maybe have body cameras or this, that, and the other thing, or like have, like, you know, police officers like do photo ops where they show like, hey, we're actually nice and blah, blah, blah. Like that. That's what I mean by like window dressing. But there's been nothing substantive to systemically reform the police or fundamentally change how policing is done. So. And the police keep still doing what they're fucking doing. So that's why there's a cynicism. So especially on something like, again, police reform, nothing substantial on a legislative level. There was some like fucking George Floyd and Policing Act, but like that hasn't really like done anything. Like there's been no effect from that. So that's why there's a cynicism. Like on issues that matter to the Black community in the United States, there have been no significant structural changes, and the material conditions of Black America have not changed. So that's why Black people are getting fucking cynical. Now the article continues, and they kind of this kind of brings up the Democrats' fears. So it keeps going. Some Republicans say they see an opportunity to siphon off some of those disenchanted Black voters in next year's presidential election with messaging on some key issues.
If we could just figure out how to not be so disgustingly racist, and also we're also like doubling down on fascism, but you know, those you know what's are ours for the taking, you know. Only stupider people than Democratic consultants or Republican consultants.
Yeah, I'm gonna continue, and then like I'll add my take, which is similar to yours. Jay Williams, a longtime GOP strategist in Georgia and founder of the Stone Ridge Group, a Republican firm, said school choice in transgender and LGBTQ plus issues, especially as they relate to children in schools, could harm Democrats among their reliable base. My guess is Democrats for the foreseeable future will continue to do well with Black voters, but I think there's some cultural issues that don't typically resonate with the Black community as a whole, and frankly, a lot of minority communities, Williams said. Republicans will be able to peel off some folks off based on that, depending on the area. It could be a real wedge issue for us. So basically, like, what this guy is saying, what the Republicans are trying to do, is that, like, yeah, on, like, some small, like, cultural issues, there's some strain of, I guess you could say, like, cultural, like, basically, I wouldn't even say that, like, black people, Asians, and Latinos are extremely conservative on cultural issues. I mean, maybe some. I think some communities are more than others. I think it's more nuanced. But I think, like, the language of wokeness in general, right, when it comes to cultural issues, it is something that, like, I think a lot of black people just don't really fuck with that much. It's not that, like, Black America is completely opposed to LGBTQ issues. It's just like more of the way the Democrats present it. Like, it's like the language and presentation of woke of just like being woke, TM, isn't something that excites Black voters that much. Again, it's the concern is more on,
or at least not the ones they're worried about.
Yeah, like
the, and
oh, go ahead.
I was gonna say, like, it's definitely like I mean, first of all, it's based on, like, well, yes, of course black men are violently homophobic, you know how they are, so of course this is gonna, we're gonna clean up on that. I really like it. I don't think it's that much of a motivating factor. And also, like, they don't like, it's not going to make them vote for Republicans. They, like, this is what these people don't get, is that, like, yeah, whatever, people might have bad opinions about this stuff, whatever. I, you know, there's a lot of, like, I don't want to use the word hotep, but whatever the equivalent of that is, or at least, like, a lot of content creators and stuff who, for some reason, don't understand that, like, most of the transgender in schools and sports panic is, like, from the people that also want to do black genocide. But either way, like, just because they don't have, like, a positive view, you know, a problem, just because, like, someone has a problematic view, that's not going to get them to vote for Republicans. They're not going to register. They're just not going to vote, but they're not going to register and join the Republican Party that they know hates them. They know every black man that's paying attention and has an ounce of self-respect knows the Republican Party wants them dead. They all know it.
Right, exactly. And so, also, on the whole, like, charge, like, ugh, black men are so problematic on, like, blah, blah, blah issue. Like, that's the argument. Thing that's not backed up by actual data. Like, when you look at actual, like, black men's opinions on cultural issues, like, especially when it comes to, like, LGBTQ issues, like, black men's actual opinion is a little more progressive, right? So, black men aren't, like, as a group, inherently reactionary. That's just, like, a caricature that was created by white liberals and white liberal feminists, basically. Like, that, so, that's just, like, a caricature and a stereotype, but it's not, like, the black men's thoughts, I think, are, like, a little more progressive and slightly more nuanced. Are there black men who are reactionaries? Yes, but that, not every black man you meet is, like, Umar Johnson or some shit, or Tariq Nasheed, you know what I mean? Like, so it's but and here's the thing, like, the way that black men are caricatured, like, it doesn't get done for, like, white women. So, like, should we point to, like, I don't know, fucking Ann Coulter and be like, yeah, god, white women are so fucking batshit conservative? People be like, well, no, like, oh, I'm a liberal white woman, I'm not like her. Like, we can accept, like, white women have, like, a range and diversity of opinion, right, and nuances, and, like, we can, and even on some segments of the left, when you bring up, like, racist white voters, there's people on the left who are like, well, you know, not all working class white people are reactionary and racist, like, there's some who, like, so we can accept nuance when it comes to other demographics, but, like, there's not the same level of nuance when it comes to black men and how black men actually think. Now, are there reactionary black men? Yeah. There are reactionaries in every fucking community. Right, they exist in any ethnic demographic. You can pick them anywhere, like Filipinos, Mexicans, Chinese, Japanese people, white people, European immigrants,
yeah.
Women of different groups. There are reactionary women, right? So there's, whichever community you look at, they're going to be reactionary. They're reactionary gay people, right? There are some very fucking reactionary ass gay and queer folks. Not all of them are, like, super progressive. There's a lot of them who are fucking reactionary. So, yes, you're going to find reactionaries in any specific group, even marginalized groups. And so Republicans are just trying to like pick that as a wedge issue, but that doesn't mean like all members of the community like think like a hive mind on specific.
Also, like the muscle isn't there. Like it works as a wedge issue for white people because of the Christian right and their turnout machine. The black church is not going to do it. It's not going to turn out for Republicans over hating trans people. That doesn't make any, that's not in their interest to do so. They get nothing from doing that. There's like, if you like, those wedge issues work because of the turnout machine of the Christian right. That's why they work for white people. That's what I'm saying, is that it doesn't matter what anyone's opinion is about this stuff on an individual level. Whatever some dumbass survey or whatever that you made up says, so you can make your pathologizing point, because it's not a motivating issue for black men to vote for Republicans.
Exactly. Right.
It's just not.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. You're 100% right. And also, it wasn't black men who authored the legislation to like basically make trans people kill themselves. Like, black men didn't create that legislation. Or the legislation to be like, yeah, let's ban gay marriage in like the 2000s. Like, there wasn't black men who collectively got together and be like, yeah, let's pass legislation to make it so that like it's okay to like kill trans people on site and get away with it, or like make it so that like trans people want to kill themselves. In fact, like Tony Thurmond, a black man, he's the state superintendent of schools in California. He went to a school board meeting somewhere in Southern California, and he actually spoke on behalf of queer students because there was this this measure in the school district to basically make it so that like trans kids would be outed, and there are a lot of queer students who felt very threatened by that. And this black public official in the state of California, Tony Thurmond, spoke in solidarity with them. And he got kicked out of the school board meeting. So, I guess that's another example of, like, a reactionary black male who hates gay people. Who, you know, this black man spoke on behalf of queer students. So, anyway. But, yeah, like, it wasn't black men who created the fucking legislation to curtail the rights of queer people and especially trans people, right? Because the Republicans are really, really trying to make a wedge issue out of trans people and turn them into a boogeyman, which is incredibly fucking grotesque. Like, the people who do that, I'll continue with the article, but I just want to say, like, the people who do that are, like, some of the biggest fucking scumbags on the planet. Like, for some reason, it makes them feel good that, like, yes, oh, I'm so sick of, like, the pronouns and trans people. So, oh, okay, so you have to sign legislation to curtail their rights and make them fearful for their lives. Like, the people who dedicate, like, their political energy to do that are, like, some of the most disgusting people on the fucking planet. Like they are such pieces of fucking dog shit.
Yeah, I shouldn't say what I would want to do to those people, but I just say I don't think there's a place in hell hot enough for the people that are driving this wave of panic. It's disgraceful.
It is.
So yeah, I don't know. I don't know if we need to talk about that anymore. We're at 1:33.
I'll just read one more part and then we can just wrap up. Because I mean, I think we've talked about it enough. But anyway, it kind of continues. Williams acknowledged any growth in support among black voters could be harder for the GOP if Trump is a nominee, and there will be many other groups, including suburban white women, that the party will have to worry about in that case. He added that he expects Republicans will have a better return on investment with other minority voting blocs, such as Latinos and Asian Americans, because I don't think they're as in lockstep with the Democrats as a black voter bloc is. Meanwhile, Democrats say they are significantly more worried that black voters will sit out rather than defect to the Republicans. And it kind of continues. Oh, in Detroit, liberal organizers targeting black turnout have made education about how politics work a centerpiece of their pitch, along with concrete examples of policies that have benefited people from the state and federal legislation. There is a slow leaking of black men from the base because the issues that they care about aren't being addressed. Duh. There, finally, someone gets it. Said Brandon Snyder, executive director of Detroit Action, whose organizers tell people the exercise is more like writing a Yelp review than to spur change. Oh, so politics is a Yelp review? Okay.
That's real politics, baby. That's the hard work. That's the hard, boring, of slow boards or whatever. That's what doing the work is about. Okay, if you're serious about change, you just don't want to just complain on the internet. You better write those fucking Yelp reviews for change. That's what real politics in the Democratic Party in 2023 is. Why don't people want to vote for us?
You have to just keep posting. Just post. Keep posting, and it's like Matt Crisman talked about. It's like, yeah, just keep posting. That's what the liberal message is. Just
keep honking. I'm reposting. I'm
retweeting and posting. That's how you fight the Republicans. Anyway, he continues. We have politics that were created by both Democrats and Republicans that don't get to the heart of what our community cares about. It's not even like that. These policies don't get to the heart of what our community cares about. It's not just that. Like, Democrats and Republicans have gotten together and have passed policies that have hurt Black people. Right, that's the real damning thing, is like there is like bipartisan consensus on certain issues that hurt Black people, especially when it comes to policing, right, and housing, you know. So like Democrats, especially in California, are pretty fucking conservative when it comes to housing issues, especially for poor people. But anyway, that's enough about that article. But we'll put this article in the show notes. But the real concern is that Black people, particularly Black men, are just going to sit out the vote. So Black men are not going to turn out for Republicans in large numbers. So that we already nailed that. So, but obviously, like, look, we don't really believe in a two-party system and like that it works in the interests of Black people. But I think this article is interesting because of you know, there's a concern of another Republican victory. And I think, like the big concern that I think Democrats should be worried about is who's going to be the nominee. Like, it seems like Biden's going to run again, but people aren't excited about Biden. So there has to be someone else that the Democrats can put forth to inspire people to vote for.
I think it's time to reveal you know, we're doing our first endorsement for president, and RSH is endorsing Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for president, for the Democratic nominee. He's what he says is what we think, and that is our pick for that is the official. We did our first political endorsement. Just kidding, folks. He's so obviously like a rat fuck operation. Like, he's so obviously funded by Steve Bannon. It's not even, they're not even trying.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, really who we want is, Cornel West, or I don't know, to be honest, like, Cornel West is like the one person who's running currently who is the closest to our political views. I don't know if Cornel West would win, but I'm excited to see his candidacy.
I'm excited.
The system. I'm cool with that. Like,
I'm excited to see the most rabid Democrat goons who are just gunning for a position in the next administration, who are going to empty the clip and do every single disgusting thing they can to character assassinate Cornel West. Great in The Matrix, honestly. Matrix Reloaded.
Yeah, Matrix
too. That's my, no, I don't, I'm voting for Afro Man. He supports reparations.
Nice. You know what, like, Marianne Williamson does deserve some credit as well for supporting reparations, so, like, she's, you know, up there as well.
Why are we cynical about the political process, Adam? Why aren't we excited to vote for these Democrats? What's wrong with us?
I know. Yeah, what is wrong with us? I mean, you know, we're just dude bros who, you know.
Yeah, or it's just so problematic.
We're so problematic. We're not, like, Yeah, we just, you know, it's just, we're just a bunch of dude bros who just don't care about the two-party system. It's just,
we don't care about anyone less privileged than us. Anyway, I was going to have more to say last week about the implosion of the Pac-12, and our, alma mater, because I just thought it was pretty insane. And like a good example of America, like not like sabotaging its own, long-term self-interest. 'Cause it's like, usually America likes winning gold medals, so they shouldn't like take a lot of money from two of the athletic departments that provide the U.S. Olympic team with like most of their gold medals. But it appears that your favorite and mine, Adam, Miss Condoleezza Rice, is on the case. Subjecting a few holdouts in the ACC to a little enhanced interrogation to literally whip some votes. So I think probably in the next week or so, we'll discover that
she's good at whipping for sure.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Stanford and Cal may end up in the, Atlantic Coast Conference along with, 'cause W didn't want to miss out on the fun. So he's getting in with a Southern Methodist University, which is in Fort Worth, Texas. It's in Dallas. It's in DFW, whatever. So yeah, anyway, that's the news on the college sports team front. But man, it's nice to know you got some literal killers on deck.
I will say, like, I guess of what you were previously said about like why we don't care about the two, like, yeah, I don't care because just look for the reasons in that article that were stated. Like, there's been very little change in the material conditions for Black people and other oppressed communities, and so yeah, that's my cynicism. And like, I mean, Condoleezza Rice, her being a fucking torturer and war criminal, those are issues I care about, especially having traveled to Guantanamo and reported there. You know, like, those are issues I care about, issues of empire policing, economic inequality, like the issues that I personally care about. Yeah, Democrats and Republicans have largely worked together to implement really shitty policies that's why I'm cynical about the two-party system. So that doesn't mean I particularly want Republicans to win, like, because that's just gonna be worse. But to go from one party that has a plan to completely fuck everybody over to another party that's like, yeah, we're just not going to do anything. I mean, even on something like, let's say, like the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the right to abortion, Democrats knew that the Republicans were going to do that, but they didn't like do anything to stop it. They're just like, oh, well, that sucks. Like, one of the key issues that Democrats raised as to why they're better than the Republicans, they didn't put up a fight to enshrine abortion as a right, at least on the federal level. So like, it's not even Matt Chrisman has been saying this, and it's not something I thought about, but as I observe it, I think he has a point. At this point, it seems like the Democrats seem to be incapable of doing anything just in terms of how the party is structured. So it's like, okay, the party's incapable of really implementing progressive change, and then the Republican Party is completely capable of fucking people over, and it's like, that doesn't sound like a really good choice.
Well, I think what's funny is that it's like, there's actually been a lot of great organizing work on the state level, in, you know, places that aren't blue strongholds to protect abortion rights with valid initiatives. And that's like, it's actually like activists and organizers are learning how to do the thing, but it's in spite of the Democratic Party. And right, those people with those talents, you can't just then expect them to come calling. You can't just call them up and expect them to all fall in line. Like, at some point, like, you're creating a, there will be like a, you know, movements and, you know, groups and everything that will learn how to organize to for their own self-interest, but they won't have any loyalty to the Democratic Party because the Democratic Party doesn't know how to actually protect them and fight for those people. And yeah. So, like, you know, it's just the electorate's going to get smaller and smaller, and they're going to focus on the narrow bands, which is what they've been doing for the past 40 years. So why would they do anything differently now? That, like, if it just the most cursory understanding of American history shows you what this party is and whose interests it serves. And that the only people who are in denial about that are election consultants.
And I will say, like, I guess to end on a more positive note, to piggyback.
I thought that was a very positive note.
I would say, like, the thing that gives me hope is the increasing unionization efforts, right? So I think to get the change that we would like to see, won't entail voting en masse for the Democratic Party. What it will entail is a rising labor movement and unionizing and workers organizing among themselves, organizing in the workplace and in their own communities. So I think that's really the only hope we have left, is people at the grassroots level organizing and stronger unions, because that's always, unions have always been like the strongest weapon that the left has had.
That's the engine that drives the car. Is what I always say. And so right now a lot of us are arguing about what the car should look like, where it should go, what color it should be, what features it should have, ignoring the fact that there's no engine in the car. So why don't we focus on putting an engine in the car, and then we can figure out where we're going to go with it. But right now, there's no engine in the car. So
Yeah, exactly. So that's what's really going to help us, is unionization efforts, worker cooperatives, grassroots activism. That's really what changes shit. Changes things that matter, and at a scale where it improves the lives of people. So I am all here for more organizing efforts. I support it. We support it. So just more solidarity to workers organizing and unionizing. Let's see more of it. Let's support more of it. The Democrats don't give a shit about us, but all we have is each other. So
all in that, that's a bit, that's way more hopeful than what I said.
Yeah. I mean, cause we get pretty doomer on this. And so it's something I'm trying to be aware of, and like, yeah, there's a lot of shit that is like depressing, sad, and
that's, you know,
fucked up. But, there are reasons to be hopeful and inspired. And yeah, one of the biggest is unionizing.
The human spirit is not dead yet.
Yeah.
We're not going to let ourselves just willy-nilly just slide into the AI dystopian theocratic fascist future that is, you know, what they've got planned for us. But, you know.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. So on that note, that's the end of this episode. RealSankarHours.org. Become a patron at patreon.com/RealSankarHours. Again, everything's on our website, RealSankarHours.org. How to support us, and where to find us, where to listen to us, all that type of shit. So, thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you want to listen to bonus episodes, again, just become a patron for $5 a month. That keeps this podcast going. So anyway, so let's sign off. Keep the faith,
stay dangerous.
All right, peace out, y'all.
Peace, dogs.